Now with a virtual world, we're actually able to engage with scientists from different parts of the world and then connect with their networks.
There has become sort of broad recognition that we have a responsibility in higher education to provide our PhD students with a broader set of skills and competencies.
That can be another way of getting information that you might not know.
You're listening to Vitamin PhD, a podcast from Boston University delivering career narratives and know-how to supplement your doctoral studies.
Welcome to Vitamin PhD. Today, my co-host Rohan and I are talking about communicating with a broad audience. We are joined by Dr. Ritu Raman, an associate professor at MIT, and Dr. William Gayak, currently completing an ORISE fellowship at the U.S. Department of Energy. Before we get started today, we thought we should ask our guests what species of tree they would use to describe themselves.
I fall under the very New England seasonal ones where my colors change as the weather changes. I'm nice and happy and bubbly all through summer. And then winter comes around and I'm like, I don't need all this color around me. Let's stick to the same black jacket to keep me warm.
My name is Ritu Raman. I am the Dartwell Office Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. When I'm in the lab or thinking about the lab, what I focus on is learning about the neuromuscular system, how we navigate our world, how that changes in response to disease or damage, and how we can restore mobility to people who have lost it. I'm also really interested in thinking about how we can take insights from how we navigate our world and transform into how robots navigate the world. Outside of the lab, I'm really interested in advancing the participation of girls and women in science and STEM disciplines in general, involved with a lot of different mechanisms and outreach organizations to help people get excited and stay excited about science careers, because I think they are amazing and give us a lot of opportunities. And outside of that, I really like to write. So I'm also a writer, very interested in science communication, and I can talk a little bit more about that in the future, but happy to be here. I think maybe I would be a weeping willow, only because I've always thought that was my favorite tree, and I'm not like a super weepy, cryy person. I mean, I do cry a lot, but I think I'm a pretty perky, optimistic person, but just for purely shallow reasons, I love weeping willows and how they look in the breeze, and I think it kind of looks like my hair, so I guess a weeping willow would be my tree.
Hello, my name is William Gayak. I also go by EM, so that's William with the will chopped off. I am a somewhat recent PhD student, I guess if 2 years is recent. I'm a former MERSCIEN fellow at the National Academies of Sciences. More recently, for the last year and a half, I have been an energy efficiency and renewable energy science and technology fellow, also known as an ORISE fellow. Where I work on water security, critical materials, education workforce development, and diversity, equity, and inclusion within the Advanced Manufacturing Office. I am very much interested in the agency of historically excluded communities. And so I'm looking to help build agency on the individual basis within those communities, and then to help uplift those communities to be more, to have more environmental justice, equity, and inclusion. Oh, and if I were a tree, I would likely be a maple, one of the maples, because I'm definitely always filled with sugar. That's probably my Achilles heel. I love candy and sweets and stuff like that. I love to bake. So whether it's cookies, whether it's pies, there's always probably way more sugar than I need to have in my body.
Ian, we would get along so well, because whenever I have something that I need to like get excited about, I take a shot of maple syrup right before. Just like powers me up.
And I love maple syrup. Maple syrup is delicious.
I don't know. I study trees a lot for my research and like street trees and stuff, but the tree that just has always been my favorite is the beech tree. I just think it's really, really beautiful. I love kind of the ginormous branches and the shade it creates. So I personally find a lot of peace looking at beech trees. So I think I might have to choose that one. it really kind of immediately came to mind as Rohan sprung that question upon us.
This has been great. So I think in our second episode, we ended on a note of how trees are critical to environments and nature and sustaining human life as well, because people came from the trees. With all these trees and all this talk of maple syrup, I now want pancakes. So something that we've heard a lot through all our episodes, and our guests in the previous episodes have said in different ways, but distilled to the same point of, when it comes to science communication, when it comes to advocacy, you kind of just have to put your foot out there. You just need to get your foot in the door. You need to start going with something, anything. And we wanted to start off this conversation with, how did each of you start your trajectory? Or, you know, to what point can you remember, oh, this is where, if I was to think back now, at that point in time in history, did I branch to want to get to where I am today?
Well, maybe I can start. I don't know if I had any grand defining moment, but I think kind of what brought me where I am today is just sort of a lot of movement and dynamic adaptation in my life. So I moved around a lot growing up. I grew up in India and Kenya and all over the United States. Never lived anywhere for more than a couple of years. Boston is actually where I've lived the longest as of this month. So I grew up kind of with a lot of different things changing, and kind of the only constant thing in my life was my parents, who are both engineers. And so I think even though I considered a lot of different paths and careers at some point, you know, I was like fashion designer, like professional athlete, all of the normal things. I think I just really like and get along with my parents and really respect what they were doing, which is to use science innovation as a force for doing something positive in their communities and in the world. So I think engineering was something I sort of kind of fell into, but then specifically thinking about, you know, the sort of things I get really excited about, which is like mobility and robots. I can narrow that down actually to one specific experience. So I was an international student when I was an undergrad. My first ever job as a teenager was this unpaid internship where all I had to do was help this biology lab that was studying how exercise affects animals. And they just wanted an undergrad to sit in the basement for hours and hours every day and put drunk rats on treadmills and look at, like, how does their skeletal muscle get stronger in response to degeneration because they're like chronic alcohol abusers. It was kind of a terrible job. I didn't like it very much because I was just stuck in this basement for hours with a bunch of drunk, tired rats who were mad at me all the time. But it did make me think about the fact that these bodies of these animals were dynamically changing to adapt to the needs of their environment. And I was like, how come none of the robots that we're building can do things like that? Like, I'm a mechanical engineer. I'm supposed to be using these kinds of materials in my work, but I'm not. And so it kind of really shifted the way I was thinking about engineering to thinking like, oh, it really has to include biology and biological materials. And maybe if we integrate that into machines, we can not only understand how to, you know, better manipulate robots around the world, but also learn something about human biology while we're doing it. So that was a very specific, funny experience for me.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know if there were any particular like pivot points that led me to where I am in my current career and or advocacy efforts, but there were, have been people that have been sort of catalysts in my career and sort of like maturation as, I guess, a human and being more conscious and aware of both my education and then my interactions with other people in the community. I think in particular, my parents at the time of high school graduation couldn't afford to put me into like a UCLA or UCSD or something like that, four-year institution. And so I wasn't eligible for any fellowships at that time to be able to go to those schools. So I made the decision to go to community college, which they have, there's so much good in community colleges, but there's a lot of sort of like taboos with them. And so I was really fortunate to have some really awesome professors who got to know me, who were willing to put in the time and the effort to this young gay Latino that wasn't really sure what he wanted to do essentially with his life, had some vague ideas, but was, they were willing to work with me to sort of develop like an individual development plan and to talk to me about the possibilities of careers and of options, because like I've always wanted to have an impact that's beyond myself. And so being able to have positive effects on my communities was very important to me. And so I would say that is what kind of led me into the direction that I'm in today. And other similar instances have led me into, you know, higher education and into advocacy spaces as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's really just interesting to hear about like how people get to where they are today. Kind of bouncing off of what you both said, obviously you both now are involved in advocacy and outreach and science communication in some type of way. Can you like think of kind of your first experience doing that? Maybe when it clicked that you're like, oh, I actually want to be engaging more with people or doing research geared more towards policy or reaching out to women in STEM. Kind of what started those interests and maybe how they've evolved over time and maybe how your ability to communicate science maybe has changed through those efforts versus when you were a PhD student to now.
That's a really good question, because I think there was a time, I mean, it wasn't like I was always born doing advocacy or something like that, necessarily in the same way. And I haven't really thought about what that trigger would be. I kind of think, you know, for me, like I mentioned, I was always moving around a lot, right? So I was like always the new kid, or when you're an international student and you're on a dependent visa on your dad's job, your dad loses his job, you could be deported in 3 months. Like it was constantly just this like fight for survival for me. Like, what is the next step? What's happening 2 weeks from now? I think in that sense, a lot of what I was doing is just like figuring out what other people were telling me, asking for advice, trying to get somewhere. I think a lot of the formal women in STEM stuff I started doing was actually in grad school. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that was right around the time that I got my green card and had like a job that I knew I would have for 4 to 5 years. So probably when I had that sense of stability and started to think about like, oh, how can I build community? And, you know, a lot of my outreach initially started as I'm a mechanical engineering PhD student. I don't see any women in any of my classes or anything. So how do I make friends? I will start an organization. And then building from that, I think those experiences were so good where I realized that sort of bi-directional communication between women who are peers, women who are a few years ahead of you, women who are a few years behind you, was so good and so rewarding that I sort of broadened out from that and incorporated it into everything I do. And it doesn't feel like work to me. I think it's just like one of the nicest parts. You know, sometimes you do science for 5 years and it doesn't really go anywhere. But like 2 days ago, I got an email from a girl who had emailed me 2 years ago saying she was thinking about dropping out of engineering because she couldn't get through. And we exchanged a few emails back and forth. And now she's on the dean's list. And she thinks that's because of me. I don't think it is, but you know, it's just nice. Like that's not the kind of rewarding thing you always get from other aspects of your job. So maybe that was the trigger for me, is once I skipped out of self-preservation mode.
Yeah, I think it's along the lines of that. Similarly, I had volunteered to be part of this thing while at the community college called the Biotechnology Education Training Sequence Investment, which was NSF funded program to be able to create biotechnology technicians at the community college to be able to work in biopharma and related biotechnology areas. And I was fortunate because the professors were very supportive of me, but they also allowed me opportunities to go into high schools to bring biotechnology programs to train high school students within, this was within San Diego County, California. And so while I was there, I had the opportunity to both train and teach students on the technologies that I was learning about, to be able to do DNA analysis, to do DNA extractions, which I found extremely rewarding and fun, but at the same time, a little bit depressing in that I could see that there were differences between different populations of students with sort of their sort of fundamental like background or basics that they had at their level. So some of them were like a few levels lower in terms of education than they should have been for their grade level. And so to me, that was very sad to see that these students weren't being, let's say, properly prepared for these sort of like advanced educational experiences later in life to be able to go into these potentially high paying jobs. It was almost as if those choices were already being made for them if they were behind several grade levels. And so to me, that was very upsetting. And that kind of got me on the road towards more advocacy oriented pathways. It's because of not seeing people like me is the reason why I want to do this work. I want to see more people that look like me and look like all the faces that are across America or across our localities represented in science policy, in STEM, and more generally, wherever they want to go is where I want to see them.
Yeah, I think both of y'all said this, the same notion of impact beyond yourself. And it's something that kind of started in or felt most strongly in grad school, where there's the job security. Each of you started thinking about outreach and this impact beyond oneself. What was the kind of accessibility available at that point? And how do you think that space has changed now where y'all are at?
That's a super great question on accessibility. I mean, there's maybe several different takes on that, like accessibility in terms of those historically excluded communities, accessibility in maybe a more literal sense, like how accessible is it to persons with disabilities? I think in particular, I mean, there's a lot of intersectional overlap there, but in particular, accessibility for persons with disabilities is something that still needs to be addressed and is still problematic, especially in grad school. A lot of experience by both myself and some of my peers and I think the larger grad school community has been an inability to address sort of mental health issues within that system. I think there are still very few levers and money being put into that to increase accessibility in that sense, but in the sense of also including historically excluded, marginalized, underrepresented communities, it's still very much inaccessible to that. There's this idea of a hidden curriculum. And so it's kind of the idea, maybe other people can more intelligibly put it into a definition, but I think by saying it's sort of like the curriculum that the privileged don't even have to think about because they have the levers and things already in their favor that people that aren't in the majority that aren't of those privileged or don't have those privileges, they have to overcome them. They're obstacles. And so it's like knowing that, you know, if you want to get to grad school, you have to do research during undergrad for the most part. And, you know, who does that favor? It usually favors people that are well-to-do. People that are lower income may have to deal with more familial issues, have to deal with several jobs to be able to successfully complete undergrad. And so they may not have time to do research. And so accessibility in terms of that, that's still something that hasn't been properly addressed.
Yeah, maybe I can comment on sort of how I see accessibility evolving over time, specifically, say, in the women in science space. I think when I was younger and growing up more, a lot of dialogue was about how do we get girls excited about science? As though the issue was that like young girls were walking around being like dinosaurs, I don't care. Outer space, not interesting to me, right? Like that's not true. Most kids find those things exciting. And the question is not, how do you get people excited, but how do you stop other people from discouraging that excitement with them? So I've seen one kind of promising thing in this sort of accessibility or outreach evolving over time that I've thought about is that now the conversation is evolving a little bit, and there's more about, you know, not just recruiting, but how do we support and promote people throughout these processes that we bring them into. There's more of a dialogue around, there's not just one kind of way to be a woman in science. For example, I'm involved in this AAAS initiative called If Then Ambassadors, and there's like 125 different women of different ages who look very different, who present very differently, varying levels in the spectrum of femininity and what they're excited about and what their hobbies are. And so I don't expect that I'm going to be the single unique role model for every little girl out there, but here's a bunch of them. And so I think all of that is great. But I do agree with what Ian was saying right around the end of, I think one branch of accessibility that we're still not really capturing in this experience is more of that sort of socioeconomic bracket of experiences. I mean, for example, you know, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, you should do this research experience, and like you would volunteer and all those things. And I volunteered because I had to, because I wasn't allowed to earn money because of my visa status. But if I were, I would have probably chosen a job that paid instead because I needed the money. And this sort of thing is just people, I don't think it's done maliciously. It's just something that people don't really think about. And then when they're evaluating people's applications or portfolios, it's just like, why didn't they take the time to do this unpaid research for 16 hours a week? You know, maybe they were working at Starbucks because they needed Starbucks' great healthcare plan. You don't know. So that part, I think, is something that we still need to address. But at least we've made progress in realizing that there's many different types of, you know, role models that we need to be looking at in the process.
Thinking back to undergrad, how it took a lot to, like, I worked as a summer orientation staff to kind of get housing sorted, because I think that was just like my pride. And I'm like, I'm not going to ask my parents for money for the summer because I want to do research, because they're already putting out everything they could for me to be here. But there's also now this discussion of, you know, what do you do once you're in? You know, the it's almost like the competition doesn't stop. The feeling that you're in a rat race. We've kind of gone into this tangent. I don't think Jess and I were anticipating going down this road, but we've somehow landed up here. And so let's just take the conversation in that spirit. You try to get into whatever professional program, and then you face those same challenges again in a different light, and you feel tired and exhausted, but you just need to keep going. Where does equity come into play?
This is, you know, honestly hard for me to talk about because I'm just coming out of one of those times in my life. So I mentioned that the first time I met Rohan was 2 years ago when I started my faculty job search process. And the reason it was 2 years is because a pandemic happened. And so, you know, a lot of the jobs that I thought I was doing really well for, they either canceled their searches or they had to rescind the offers that they had made me. Or, you know, they made a choice based on like, oh, this person does more computational work, so we'll be less of our budget to support them, so we'll hire that person instead of this person, which often tends to be a man because that the feeder area from computer science tends to be predominantly male. And so I went through this whole year and that year really, so starting last March till about a couple months ago, feeling very, very defeated, feeling like there's nothing I can do, I'm never going to get a job, or like I can't afford to sit around and be a postdoc forever. It was very, very tough. And I think you're asking a really important question here, which is that everybody goes through those times that are really difficult. But some of us have more privilege and more resources in combating that time, right? So like I had the privilege of a postdoc advisor who was like, stay as long as you want. doesn't matter to me. I had the privilege of having parents who didn't really need me to earn more money in order for them to keep doing their thing. And I had, you know, access to a home and a lot of people that I could talk to, and like broadband that enabled me to talk to people in a safe way so that I didn't have to like sit around being isolated all the time. So I think one aspect of things that we could do when we're thinking about this line of things, is that when people are hit with these really hard and difficult times in science, which pretty much always happen, what are the ways that somebody with a lot of privilege addresses that issue? And then what are ways that maybe we can support people who don't have access to those same set of things, whether that's through bridge funding to support them through till the next application cycle, or something else? Like, it was so lucky that I got to ride it out right up until the time that MIT was like, JK, we're back again, here's a job. But if, you know, I just had to take another job before then I wouldn't get to be a professor at MIT. And I think there are a lot of people who fall into that category who were just as smart and hardworking and just as deserving of having a lab that don't have that lab right now. And it's unfair, it really is. So that's some, you know, maybe one way that we can think about it.
Yeah, this is very tough. I agree with Rita's comments. I don't know, because like at all these different points in my career, even though like post PhD, I'm only what, like 2 years out, it seems like this is a common occurrence at multiple levels, whether you're in the academic or government or maybe industrial environments. There's a lot of like competitive behavior. And so how do you address the issues of equity that come about because of that, right? One of the things that I see potentially as maybe addressing this, I don't know how well it can address it, but you know, just throwing it out, kind of hand waving, maybe mentor-mentee relationships. Because part of being able to work in a system that you don't know about can be, you know, to your, you can gain advantage by having someone who's already part of the in group, especially if you aren't already part of the in group. That's maybe one way of addressing it. But I think this might need more reflection and maybe a whole season to try and like suss out, like, you know, what can we do, and you know, maybe bring in some more people with more experiences in this area. But I'm thinking about like the science policy fellowships that I apply to. I think they're more, or in theory, they're more oriented for people with an interest in it, that they're not just maybe like switching out of academia on a whim because they're bad at it, whatever bad is. Definitely there's inequitability there. Like things are very much unequal, and trying to figure out how to make things fair and accommodating for people to come in at any entry point, right? Because science, in the case of science policy isn't like one point. There's like many different pathways to get to science policy, and many, you know, sort of even directions within that. I'm reminded of, I don't remember what the exact quote is, but it's kind of like crabs in a container or something. Like they just kind of claw each other. And so no one can really make it up to the top because everyone's trying to be at the top. And so like, I just want to be able to prosper. I don't want to be a crab. I don't want other people to be crabs. I want them to exceed and excel. So I think in terms of like finding areas and ways of collaboration in these efforts are very important.
I really like the crab analogy. That is something that has started. I've heard it in more than just this space recently, but for the same conversation. So I think you're onto something, Ema. I think that analogy is gaining traction.
I just need to learn the exact thing for it, like the quote, because it, yeah.
The general crab analogy, yeah, that's interesting. One thing that just came to mind kind of when both of you were talking, and it's something that I personally struggle with as a graduate student, I know others do as well. Kind of, we were talking a bit about the competitiveness that exists not only in undergraduate or getting into a PhD program, but how it really lasts and lingers throughout your time in the program as well. It's very easy for graduate students to be hyper-competitive with one another. You can be viewed differently depending on your interests in science and your experiences and kind of what type of science you do. And like we've said, you know, the theme for this podcast is science communication. And a lot of our guests, you both included, have bridged that gap to advocacy and working with communities. And I, speaking from experience, I know a lot of graduate students are nervous to kind of approach advocacy or approach more applied policy-based science or reaching out to communities just because they don't want to be viewed as not focusing on the hard sciences and staying within that ivory tower. How can we encourage graduate students to kind of view advocacy and view engagement with community as a positive and not something that they need to be ashamed of or necessarily cautious of as graduate students, as recently graduated PhDs? I struggle with it myself, like I've said. So I'm curious on your take of kind of how to balance life as a graduate student with advocacy and policy-based science.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's a legitimate fear, right? Like, I think that part of the problem is not that necessarily grad students don't want to, or they don't want to make time for it, but that, I guess I should say, we as professors, as of this week, I have a ton of privilege and power. But you know, it's important for people who hire up or are making these hiring decisions or making decisions on who gets awards and who gets this and who gets that to incentivize doing things like this. That being said, I do think that there's room for doing those things, and it doesn't necessarily hold you back in your career, or certainly I don't feel like it's held me back in accomplishing my goals. And part of that is kind of picking one thing at a time, right? Like, we can point out a million types of injustice that exist in the world. And if you try to do a little bit for everything, you would just get very overwhelmed and maybe not get very far. So, you know, I'm focusing on like women in science. When I first started, I was like graduate women in this College of Engineering at the University of Illinois. So you have a specific population with a specific set of needs, and think about like, how can I improve the community for us, people who are here? What are problems that I'm having, that my friends are having, that I can address? And then not only doing that and doing it for the good of doing it, but also being strategic about, you know, what, how you can share that and integrate that into your experience. I have won a ton of fellowships and awards and things because people are like, oh, for example, my postdoc was partially funded by the L'Oreal USA for Women in Science Fellowship. They picked me because of my science, but it certainly didn't hurt that I had done a lot of advocacy for women in science before. And so it seemed to them like I would be a good role model in that space. So you can be strategic about doing things that not only matter to you and have an impact, but telling people like, oh, like, look at this great thing I'm doing. And you shouldn't feel bad about that. And you should feel like that can feed into your career and kind of dovetail in the same way. One thing that a trap that I fall into is that then I try to do all the things because I like, I want to help them. I want to do this organization. I'll go do that outreach talk. I'll be on this podcast. And it's too much. And it does take away from science, which is the prime goal and the thing that I'm here to do. And so one way that I deal with that anxiety is that I got advice from a woman who's a professor at MIT, like established professor at MIT, who I really admire, who basically said, you know, Ritu, the best thing that you can do for women in science is to be a successful woman in science. So kind of reminding yourself that, like, if I take some time off to not do the outreach and build my lab and grow my reputation as a great scientist, that is also doing something for the community, and that doesn't make you selfish. So I think people have to kind of, you know, find one focused thing and then find a balance for them at each point in their careers of how can they feel good about what they're doing? How can they use that to build up their own careers? And how can they fight the guilt when they don't have the time or space to do that at that moment in time?
I really appreciate what you just said. Like, taking time to build yourself as a scientist is not selfish. And that is doing a service to the community that you're trying to help. That's not often put into words in my like immediate network. So I appreciate that a lot.
I would agree with that. And maybe to add on to that, like in terms of you can't, so absolutely acknowledge that you can't do everything, that you need to set priorities, you need to have boundaries. But also, I think learning to say no to things is very important. And it can be something very difficult that I'm still learning how to say no to things, because there's only a finite amount of time and energy and bandwidth that you have. And so, yeah, that's going to be something that you'll take with you for every aspect of your life. And it'll be very important so that you can have the right balance of work, life, and other activities. But maybe along the lines of maybe getting more involved in like advocacy, policy, and whatnot, it's a very strange space to be in a sense, especially as a grad student, when the power dynamics might be different between you and your advisor or advisors, if you're co-advised. My suggestion would be to find people and an environment that are supportive of you and your efforts. Be you, whoever you are, you know, and your interests. Make sure that, you know, you get the good sort of science aspects, scientific method, you know, that sort of experiences and knowledge transfer. But if you also want to be a science communicator, if you want to be a science advocate, if you want to do advocacy, do that too. Definitely, you know, find the right balance. But finding an environment that is willing to support you and those efforts. I say this because I also want to acknowledge that there are some advisors who are not supportive. I've experienced it, and I've heard from other people their experiences where PIs, like in my case, I got called up at a conference and was told, if I'm not back by tomorrow, then I'm not going to have a job. It was just a crazy choice between the science that I love, and then also this advocacy and policy related area, which I also love. And then to be basically given an ultimatum.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Vitamin PhD. Thanks also to our producer, Sasha Goldman, and editor, Farah Sohn, for putting together this episode. You can get the latest episodes of BU Vitamin PhD on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about our team, stay connected, and share feedback with us over Twitter at BU Vitamin PhD. Once again, that's at BU Vitamin PhD, or by emailing us at gradpd@bu.edu. Once again, that's gradpd@bu.edu. Thank you, stay safe, and tune in for more Vitamin PhD next time.